Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, May 24th, 2019 edition of the News Gazette, and we'll begin on the front page with a piece from the University of Illinois called "Policy May Target Any Sexual Harassment." Those drafting recommendations say they're aiming for lower threshold than commonly used in legal settings. By Julie Wirth, Champaign. A sexual harassment policy less tied to legal standards and more focused on prohibiting any kind of unwanted sexual behavior is expected to be one of the draft recommendations this month from a University of Illinois committee. The 12-member committee, led by UI law professor Rob Carr, was convened in January by Provost Andreas Kangalaris and asked to provide preliminary recommendations by May 15th. Carr said the panel plans to deliver an initial draft report by the end of the month. The committee was charged with recommending changes in policies governing how the campus handles complaints of sexual harassment against faculty members, including remedies and sanctions, and how far confidentiality requirements should go. Carr, soon to be chairman of the Campus Senate Executive Committee, took the lead on the issue for the Senate last fall, following disclosures about the sexual harassment investigation of law professor Jay Keeson. The committee, which is meeting again today, is working on a draft policy, but will continue to revise it through the summer as it considers other parts of its charge from the provost. Carr hopes it can produce a final report sometime next fall. Bill Bernhardt, Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, said his office doesn't expect a finished product this month, and he's satisfied with the committee's timeline. A related committee studying a broader policy on consensual relationships between faculty members and students also expects to have a proposal ready for review next fall. Bernhardt said, "The UI generally prohibits relationships between faculty members and the students they supervise, but the policies are narrower and less detailed than those adopted by many of its peers and include no sanctions." The initial report from Carr's committee will address standards and definitions that the campus could use to prohibit sexual harassment. In the courts and other legal settings, Carr said, conduct is considered sexual harassment if it involves a quid pro quo of some benefit in exchange for sexual conduct, or if the behavior is severe or pervasive enough to create a hostile work environment. In two cases publicized last fall, involving Keeson and UI police officer Brian Tyson, investigators found the employee's conduct was inappropriate but didn't violate those strict standards. Neither received significant sanctions initially, though Keeson later took an unpaid leave of absence. "We're just thinking we should have a policy that targets sexual harassment, regardless of whether it meets those high thresholds for a severe or hostile work environment," Carr said. "We want a system that is less focused on legal compliance and more focused on prohibiting sexual harassment in any form. There's a lot of things that don't create a hostile work environment that we still think a person shouldn't be engaged in," he said. A lack of clarity. The second part of the committee's charge is developing a broader range of tools and responses that can be used to protect against sexual harassment, short of dismissal, or revoking tenure, as well as a clear articulation of procedures that need to be followed before any kind of sanction can be used, he said. That work will intensify over the summer. The committee plans to work with stakeholder groups to get input, he said. The panel will also start working on how to balance issues of confidentiality and transparency. The committee wants to find a way to protect people more effectively from sexual harassment without violating the due process, academic freedom, and tenure rights of faculty members who might be accused. Those discussions are just beginning, he said. Currently, the university's statutes mention just two sanctions for faculty misconduct: dismissal or severe sanctions short of dismissal, including losing tenure, and they require a lengthy hearing process. Deans and other administrators have advocated for more tools to deal with sexual harassment claims, especially while a case is being investigated. Carr said there are a range of tools available and already being used in some departments, such as reassigning a professor's duties or oral or written reprimands. But there's a lack of clarity about how to use those measures and still protect due process, he said. And there are other responses that aren't punitive, but can help make a victim whole, he said, such as allowing a student to switch classes, providing counseling, or using a chaperone. We don't just think there's only three things you can do, and only in the biggest cases, he said. Changing behaviors. It makes sense to have more options available if the policy is going to target more kinds of behavior, he said. If we're catching more conduct in our net, we can't be thinking only of the most severe and pervasive kinds that lead to dismissal, he said. We have to be thinking there are other kinds that might warrant other measures, like an informal censure. Some research shows those milder sanctions for less severe behavior can help create a climate where more serious infractions are less likely to occur, and where people are more apt to report problems, Carr said. The feeling right now is that it's so hard to get a remedy that no one wants to report, he said. It can also be educational for the person accused, who may not understand that certain behaviors make people uncomfortable, Carr said. Just having it brought to their attention by an official person might change their behavior, he said. Regarding transparency, Carr said there are ways to protect employee confidentiality and still do a better job of assuaging students' concerns when a case arises. The campus could, for example, provide regular updates about how many cases come up each year and how these are resolved. The point is to make people feel that the processes are adequately transparent to address their concerns without revealing too many things before there are fact findings, Carr said. Sometimes people just want assurances that they're being protected and that they can rely on the fact that investigatory procedures and other remedies in place ensure that they're in a safe environment, he said. And next, a piece about the severe weather called Many Rude Awakenings as Storm Sweeps Area by Noelle McGee. Christina Cross said she and her husband Scott were asleep when the sound of high winds in the Vermilion County village of Muncie woke them up about 2:15 a.m. Thursday. We heard glass breaking, so we ran to get the three kids, she said, adding they huddled together and eventually fell back to sleep. When Cross woke up later that morning, her husband was already outside surveying the damage. I kept hearing, "Oh my gosh, oh my gosh," and it got louder and louder, she said. I thought, "This can't be good," said Cross, who walked outside to see large trees and power lines down in her backyard and an alley. The storm broke her living room window and damaged siding on her house and the one next door, which she and her husband rent to her brother. The early morning storm, which brought strong wind and rain, knocked down trees and utility poles and lines throughout Vermilion County, according to local emergency management agency officials. We had an unconfirmed picture of a funnel cloud, but we're still waiting to hear from the National Weather Service, said Director Ted Fisher. The storm's impact was felt throughout the area. In Rantoul, winds knocked over a mammoth sign pole at a filling station and left numerous homes without power. In Sibley, gusts of up to 90 miles per hour sent trees and utility poles tumbling. It was like a mile worth of poles, said Terry Whitebird, director of the Ford County Emergency Management Agency, and destroyed a camper, he said. was flipped upside down and just obliterated. In the Piatt County village of Cisco, the casualties included a century-old tree next to the firehouse that fell on the former schoolhouse lawn. The damage caused the Champaign County Forest Preserve District to call off today's Take Me Fishing event at the Middle Fork River Forest Preserve. Still ago, fishing events at Homer Lake Forest Preserve on June 22nd and Lake of the Woods Forest Preserve near Mahomet on July 27th. School's out. Just outside Oakwood, the storm also knocked over a FedEx truck with a 53-foot trailer that was heading west on Interstate 74. The crash sent the driver and a passenger to the hospital. A FedEx employee who was waiting for a tow truck said one of them had been released, but the other remained hospitalized Thursday. Fisher said there were no other reports of injuries in Vermilion County. However, the storm knocked out electricity, landline, phone service, and cable TV to hundreds of residents. Oakwood Schools, Georgetown Ridge Farm High School, and the district's early childhood program and Carl on Vermilion Street, which lost power, were closed for the day. Danville's North Ridge Middle School and Edison and Liberty Elementary Schools dismissed at 11 a.m. due to the outage. In Vermilion County, Fisher said Muncie and parts of Danville apparently got the brunt of the storm. In Danville, the neighborhoods surrounding Northeast Elementary Magnet School at 1330 East English Street were the hardest hit, said Public Works Director Carl Carpenter. He said downed trees also blocked parts of Seminary Street by the post office, North Collett, Moore, and John Streets. Crews spent the day cutting up and removing them and other large limbs that fell into the street. Very, very lucky. Muncie Mayor Cynthia Lane said she was up late monitoring weather reports on her computer and saw a bulletin saying the storm would expire at 2:45 a.m. She headed for bed, thinking the worst of it was over. Then the wind and rain came, she said. The power went out, came back, and then went out for good. U.S. 150 between Muncie and Fithian was closed all day while utility crews worked to repair 9 sub-transmission poles that had been knocked down, according to an Ameren supervisor. They also had to repair other downed poles and lines in the village and surrounding area. Lane said she and her husband, Shane Warner, who works for the Vermilion County Highway Department, were up early checking on residents and property damage. I think we were very, very lucky, she said, adding a tree fell on a roof and another on a garage, but no one was hurt. Over at her house on the north side of town, Lynn Simpson was waiting for an insurance adjuster Thursday morning. A large tree in her front yard fell on her roof, and her garage collapsed. The whole side is hanging by a fence post and a ladder, she said, of her garage. That's what's actually holding it up. Simpson said she and her husband were woken up by the wind, but didn't realize the extent of the damage until the sun came up. I'm very shocked to see this, said Simpson, who has lived in the village for more than 30 years. We're just hoping it doesn't rain, which it's going to do. We're done. Cleanup time in Cisco. In the tiny village of Cisco, population 243, emergency officials said high winds damaged at least 22 homes and downed 50 to 60 limbs, some of which ended up on village and rural roadways. It came in really fast. We don't know whether it was straight-line winds or whether it was possibly a funnel cloud that never touched. We're not sure, said Cisco Fire Chief Matt Wilhelm. A grain bin owned by Top Flight Grain Corporation was damaged, and a privately owned bin was picked up and thrown from the back of the property to the front of the property, an estimated distance of 100 yards, according to Piatt County Sheriff's Emergency Management Director Mike Holmes. For the amount of tree damage, I think we're pretty lucky, Holmes added. There are trees on houses, cars totaled, but we're lucky nothing went through and hurt anyone. Williams knew of at least 4 vehicles destroyed by falling limbs, as well as roofs being damaged on several homes. A gas leak was also reported and may require digging under a road to repair. Illinois 32 was closed after the storm until debris was cleared about daybreak. Cleanup will take a couple of days, he said. And next, from the University of Illinois, a piece called "And Array We Go." Solar installation on ECE rooftop now providing power for part of building, by Julie Worth Urbana. In April, Sunshine began powering about 25% of the labs, offices, and classrooms in one of the newest high-tech buildings at the University of Illinois. A $3 million rooftop solar array planned as part of the electrical and computer engineering building that opened in 2014 was completed this spring, pushing it closer to its ultimate goal of net zero energy use. About 950 solar panels cover two levels of the building's rooftop, divided into several arrays, including about 60 dedicated to research use. At their peak, they can produce about 275 kilowatts. The system was designed to cover about 20% of the building's electrical consumption, and facilities manager Tim Newman said Wednesday it's currently generating about 25%. There's an added benefit for the campus, officials said. Each solar panel is equipped to immediately convert the energy generated into ready-to-use AC electricity and is connected to the UI power grid. At times, when the sun is bright but building energy needs are low, the extra power is a resource for the overall campus grid, said Philip Krein, professor of electrical and computer engineering, who supervised the project. That will help the UI meet its goal by reducing energy emissions by 30% from 2008 to 2020. The building's AC solar installation is one of the largest of its kind. AC solar panels are increasingly popular for residential use, but larger systems such as the UI Solar Farm on Windsor Road typically use DC panels. With DC panels, you must avoid most shading, maintain wide spacing between rows, and make sure there are no local problems, Krein said. With AC panels, structures or even exhaust pipes that cause shading can pretty much be ignored. If one panel gets dirty or has some leaf cover or snow cover, we don't lose enough power to worry about. The lobby of the building will eventually have a giant screen and kiosk to display real-time information on how much energy the solar panels are producing with help from a $30,000 grant from the Student Sustainability Committee, said Joyce Mast, coordinator of the UI's Granger Center for Electric Machinery and Electromechanics. The original plan was to add another rooftop solar array to the top of the nearby North Campus parking garage to help reach the building's net zero energy target, but that project was deemed too expensive. Long term, the campus hopes to allot part of the second UI solar farm planned in Savoy to the electrical and computer engineering building, so 100% of its energy will come from sustainable sources, Mast said. A memorandum of understanding is being worked out with the UI facilities and services, she said. The new rooftop array on the electrical and computer engineering building was initially part of its $95 million construction. But problems arose with the state funding, bids were incomplete, and there were challenges with the original design, Krein said. The project was designed to be funded equally by state and the university. The $1.5 million from the UI included $150,000 from the Student Sustainability Committee, donor gifts, grants from the Granger Center for Electric Machinery and Electromechanics, and the Granger College of Engineering. The state of Illinois provided the other $1.5 million. The UI and Solar Bridge Technologies also received a joint grant from the Department of Energy to determine the best way to lay out a rooftop solar installation to maximize the energy produced, Krein said. Previous rules of thumb turned out not to be very accurate, he said. Researchers created a comprehensive simulator that used a year's worth of campus solar data and figured out a way to boost energy production by 30% over conventional approaches, Krein said. For example, the panels are much closer together than the original design. Installation began in earnest last October. The panels were connected in April, and the last inspection was completed May 15th, Krein said. With this final piece in place, we can really learn a lot more about what it takes to design, construct, and operate low-energy buildings. We have tools to learn about better ways to expand the use of solar energy, Krein said. The 60 research solar panels sit right outside the fourth floor Advanced Power Applications Laboratory. Cables connect the modular panels directly into a circuit breaker in the lab, where they can be rearranged for different studies. Graduate student Jason Galtieri, who hopes to complete his doctorate in a few months, will use the solar panels as the capstone of his research project. He said researchers can do a lot with simulators in the lab, but you can't beat having a solar array right outside the door. He no longer has to drag a panel downstairs and outside on a cart and stand by it all day so no one takes it. And if he's working on a panel and needs a screwdriver or a part, the lab is right through the door. It's really opened the door, not just for me, but graduate students in the future, Galtieri said. His research is focused on making solar panels easier to control, so they're more grid-friendly, specifically by reducing fluctuations in power output when the weather turns cloudy, which is tough on the grid, he said. Solar installations typically use expensive batteries to regulate the output. He's trying to find a way to have the solar installation absorb part of the fluctuations so smaller batteries can be used. And next we have a piece about transportation. White House pulls Obama proposal for train safety. It contends adding crew won't prevent rail accidents, by Matthew Brown, Billings, Montana. The Trump administration said Thursday it was withdrawing a proposal for freight trains to have at least two crew members, nullifying a safety measure drafted under President Barack Obama in response to explosions of crude oil trains in the United States and Canada. A review of accident data did not support the notion that having one crew member is less safe than multi-person crews, Department of Transportation officials said. The withdrawal also seeks to preempt states from regulating crew sizes. The 2016 proposal followed oil train derailments, including a runaway oil train in 2013 that derailed, exploded, and killed 47 people while leveling much of the town of Lac-Mégantic, Canada. Other derailments of trains carrying oil and ethanol have occurred in North Dakota, Oregon, Montana, Illinois, Virginia, and other states. Under Obama, regulators concluded that having two or more crew members would be worth the extra cost, even if it prevented a single accident. The rail industry, which long maintained that crew requirements were unnecessary, cheered Thursday's move. But a representative for a rail workers' union said it would put the public at a greater risk by removing a safeguard against accidents. Most trains currently operate with at least two crew members, but without a government regulation, there's no guarantee that could continue indefinitely. If railroads would start running single-person operators, there's nobody up there to interact to make sure everything is done right, said John Risch, Legislative Affairs Director for Smart Transportation Division, a rail workers' union. The government has essentially said we're not going to provide any oversight whatsoever. Whatever the railroads want to do, they can do, Risch said. The Federal Railroad Administration said in a statement that the rail industry has maintained a strong safety record in the absence of regulation on this issue. The statement also said a crew staffing rule would have been an unnecessary obstacle to future innovation in the industry. Thursday's withdrawal marks the latest rollback since President Donald Trump took office of safety rules adopted under Obama in the face of opposition from the energy and transportation industries. The administration this month eased inspection requirements for offshore oil and gas drilling put in place after the deadly 2010 BP Deepwater Horizon explosion and oil spill, and transportation officials had earlier rescinded a requirement for more advanced electronic brakes for trains hauling crude and other hazardous fuels. Railroad company representatives said the withdrawn crew rule would have locked them into crew sizes at a time when the industry is expanding the use of new technologies such as positive train control. Those are computer-based systems that can automatically stop trains to prevent accidents caused by high speed or collisions, allowing railroads the flexibility to adjust their operations to reflect the capabilities of technologies like PTC, positive train control, will help advance railroads' missions to achieve an accident-free future. Association of American Railroads President and CEO Ian Jeffries said. And next, a piece about a plea agreement. Restitution may erase theft rap, by Mary Shank, Urbana. An Urbana woman who admitted stealing thousands of dollars from her employer could escape a conviction if she successfully completes her sentence of court supervision. Diamond Smith, 24, who listed an address in the 2100 block of East Vermont Avenue, pleaded guilty Thursday before Judge Roger Weber to theft, admitting that on February 14, 2018, she stole the cash deposit from the Rogers and Hollins Jewelers at Marketplace Mall, where she was the manager. Although the state allowed Smith to plead guilty to a misdemeanor charge that alleged she stole under $500, Smith agreed to pay restitution of $2,159, representing half of the missing bank deposit. Her attorney, Ruth Wyman, said Smith has already repaid another $2,159 directly to the business. With no prior record, Smith could escape a conviction if she gets in no further trouble during the 12 months of her supervision, pays the restitution, and performs 20 hours of public service. And in the history section, in area history, in 1919, after the Wheatley Pool Hall in White Heath was robbed, two suspects were brought into the hall the following morning and put on the grill, with a bunch of residents serving as mock jury. When three deputies arrived, it was determined the two men could not be arrested since there was not enough evidence to hold them. In 1969, some members of the University of Illinois faculty proposed forming an organized union of professional employees. In 2004, a couple of businessmen in Gibson City opened a new sports bar called the Sand Trap, where people could play virtual golf inside out of the weather. It was located at 120 East 1st Street on the east side of Gibson City. There were golf simulators along with 9 TVs, pool tables, and ping pong tables, said manager Penny Hendricks. And we'll take a short break now and then return to the second half hour of the Friday, May 24th, 2019 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.